Welcome then to tonight's seminar, where we're going to be discussing the COVID crisis and the government's response, and whether it's changing voters' attitudes about government intervention and the role of the state in society. In a sense, whether voters are becoming effectively more left-wing. And to discuss this, we have a great panel of five people from UCL Politics. We've got the authors of the new study entitled Testing Negative, the Non-Consequences of COVID-19 on Mass Political Attitudes. And they are Tim Hicks, Tom O'Grady, and Jack Blumenau. So welcome to them. And then to discuss the implications of their findings, we have Alva Ray and Stuart Wood. And Alva is New Statesman's political correspondent. So welcome to Alva. And Stuart Wood is an Oxford University academic who has also advised Gordon Brown and Ed Miliband when he was Labour leader and is a member of the House of Lords. So the way we're going to do this is that Tim Hicks is going to talk about the study first for about 15 or so minutes. And then we will have a kind of panel discussion. And then after that, we will start questions and answers from you. So I think if we're ready to start with Tim Hicks, please.
Thanks, Anna. And thanks to everyone who's joined us this evening. I am going to share my slides with you. Can people see my slides? Yep, great. Okay. So the title then is Public Attitudes to the State Post-COVID. And this is based on some work that that Jack, Tom, Alan Jacobs and Scott Matthews and I have been doing. And essentially back in March or April, as COVID was starting to unfold, it seemed like this moment where politics might change, right? And you know, we're all sitting in lockdown and kind of messaging each other and thinking that maybe this is a big thing, and maybe we should be studying it a little systematically. We weren't the only ones. The Financial Times, this is from their editorial board on the 3rd of April, beyond defeating the disease, the great test all countries will soon face is where the current feelings of common purpose will shape society after the crisis. As Western leaders learned in the Great Depression and after the Second World War, to demand collective sacrifice, you must offer a social contract that benefits everyone, right? So as early as April, if not before, serious people were thinking this could be a moment of change. It wasn't just at March and April. So fast forward now, this is in October. So here's Ian Martin, I think a Times columnist, but speaking on The Week in Westminster. Britain is moving in a more collectivist direction. The state is going to be, for the foreseeable future, much bigger. It was a discussion actually where he was kind of talking about the ideological winds essentially being in the sails of the Labour Party. December, his Simon Sharma, coming out of the crisis, as we all hope we will, vaccine permitting, the world looks a little different. For example, nobody would now deny the crucial role of central government and state action in the common interest. Right, so there seems to have been this view that the world was kind of, or at least the UK was moving more leftwards, or perhaps should be in some sense. So that's what we want to study. And we want to try and delineate some different possible logics of how this could actually play out, right? I'm going to give them some labels. I'm going to set out three of those logics. I'm going to give them some labels. I'm not sure I'm completely happy with those labels at the moment, but they seem reasonable descriptions at the moment. So the first one I'm going to call defensibility. And this, I'm sort of harking back again to the kind of wartime spirit, right? Which I think you saw from the Financial Times quote that I just gave you, but you can see from lots of others who are discussing this sort of thing, right? So this is a quote from Titmus, who is the kind of canonical citation about the influence of war on social policy. "The acceptance of these social disciplines made necessary by war must influence the aims and content of social policies in peacetime as well." I mean, I think the idea here is, if you strike out the "made necessary by war," the acceptance of social disciplines is something that that we've come to experience in these past, how many is it now, 10 months or so. And so, there seems to be this plausible parallel, right, from the collective endeavor, right, that I don't know whether it's a collective endeavor to be clapping in the streets for the NHS, right, but there was some kind of collective spirit, right, that seemed to be manifest in the UK, and maybe that kind of at least rhymes with the sort of a wartime spirit and what might follow from it. So that on the one hand. On the other hand, there's clearly political science research, not least from Tom O'Grady, who's one of my co-authors here, that actually kind of ideology of this sort is actually quite sticky, and once you acquire it. Sort of early in your life, it's hard to move people on from it. Nonetheless, the wars did seem to have a notable effect on social policies that followed them. So the sort of what's defensible for society, right? Kind of what's kind of morally appropriate as perceived by societies. That seems like one mechanism. Another one is kind of just what's possible, right? So it may be that you were, there was a cadre of British citizens and voters and so on who had this sort of latent left-wing view, but they just thought that their aspirations for the government weren't realistic in some way, right? That it was kind of too much to expect for the government to step up in various ways. And so it was kind of, their preferences weren't really possible. But maybe the COVID crisis demonstrated what was possible. It turns out within the space of, I forget the exact timeline now, but I think it was a few weeks as I recall, the government can guarantee the income of, well, almost everyone. The Treasury can stand up a scheme like that at the drop of a hat, right? It turns out that the government could provide accommodation for homeless people again, within weeks, right? So when pressed. So perhaps this was a moment of revelation for what the kind of the left-wing power of the state could be, right? Possibly. There's another logic, I think, and this is like real sort of bread and butter political economy, which is, I think, best characterizes self-interest. I don't mean that in a sort of negative way, but I think that kind of best characterizes how we could conceive of this. So on the one hand, it's pretty well established in the scholarly literature that kind of increased labor market risk. So increased concerns that you might lose your job or your income in some way tends to lead people to be more positively predisposed towards redistribution or sort of unemployment benefits and so on. And this seems like a moment, you can see my BBC News picture here, right? This was clearly a moment when lots of people faced labour market risk. And so this was revealed to lots of people, perhaps people who hadn't expected it before. And so we might expect more support for redistribution. And similarly, to the extent that the kind of economic component of this COVID shock wasn't kind of uniformly felt up and down the income distribution, but was actually felt more towards the bottom, we might think that kind of reduced incomes at the bottom would lead people to be even more favorable towards redistribution, right? So this might pull people in a leftward direction. So those are my kind of three basic logics. We might also think that this last one may be less sort of fully, long-term ideological and perhaps something a little bit more transient, right? So if those labor market risks sort of go away or the reduced incomes go away in some sense, then perhaps that they might return to the status quo ante. So those are my three logics. And before I try and show you the data that we collected to sort of assess whether any of this happened, I want to sort of set out a little bit how we're going to approach this. So it seems to me that the kind of the defensibility logic should probably lead us to expect a reasonably generalized leftward movement across the whole population. Not sort of on average, right? Not every person, but on average, this kind of collective endeavor affected everyone. And so we should expect kind of everyone to move. And given the magnitude of the shock that we all faced, it seems to me we should expect quite a big leftward movement. The possibility logic, there are different ways to slice this, but I think a natural way to think about it is those who most directly felt the benefit of state action would be the ones for whom the sort of the revelation of what the government could do would be most salient to them. And so perhaps the most likely to move leftwards. And the self-interest one version is sort of relatively self-evident, right? Those who felt they faced a marked increase in their labor market risk, we should see them move a bit further left. And those who saw their incomes dropped, similarly, we should see them move further left. So I'm going to take you through some pictures that hopefully try and draw out the extent to which any of these things are true. So did COVID-19 make us more left-wing? The data that I'm going to take you through is drawn from the British election study, for which we should all be deeply thankful. So this is a survey that's been asking people to fill in surveys through a website or their mobile phone since 2014. It's an extremely large sample of respondents, about 30,000 or so in each wave. We're up to wave 20. As I said, it started in 2014 and has been checking back with people at various intervals, around elections and referendums and so on. So they allowed us to collaborate with them in this past year, so back in April, so that we were able to field an extra set of surveys in April and then in September under this public assessments of COVID-19 economic response project. And so we issued surveys to a subset, so 3,000 people in April and then again in September to kind of check in on how things were going with COVID. So we can track individuals before and during the pandemic, right? So we can follow an individual. This isn't a sort of drawing a new sample each time, but we can see how individual attitudes have changed. And that's what's particularly useful about this data set. They're also all freely available if you're interested in getting involved. Okay, so the first bit of empirical evidence then. So this is trying to get at the defensibility logic. And this is looking at attitudes about income redistribution. So the BES and PACER surveys asked people this. They said, some people feel that government should make much greater efforts to make people's incomes more equal. Other people feel that government should be much less concerned about how equal people's incomes are. Where would you place yourself on this scale? And it was a 0 to 10 scale. We've actually scaled it. So for all of the pictures I'm going to show you, higher values are going to be have the more left-wing interpretation. Okay. So this is what we see for this is what we see for average responses across all of these survey waves, where we've got survey weights applied. So these should be reasonably representative of the UK population. I guess there are lots of things that could be said about this. The dotted line clearly delineates sort of pre and then during pandemic periods. There's some noise in this series, but there's no obvious marked leftward shift. Certainly as compared to the kind of the pre-pandemic period on this measure. We see no obvious sort of aggregate effect here. Okay, what about if we look at attitudes about wealth redistribution? So people were asked this question. Whether they agreed whether ordinary working people do not get their fair of the nation's wealth. This was on a 1 to 5 scale. And if anything, this one looks sort of even worse for the left shift case. There's actually been a sort of fairly clear trend downwards in a rightward direction since 2014 on this one. you know, if you wanted to really say, well, I think there might have been a leftward shift, the second of the surveys that was conducted in the pandemic period, you know, did see a jump up. But compared to the rest of the trend, there's no really obvious kind of standout sort of COVID moment here. What about, instead of these kind of attitudes about sort of income and wealth, what about attitudes about the unemployed, right? So this seems like potentially a moment where perceptions of the kind of deservingness of unemployment benefit recipients might have been changed, right? This was, on the face of it, a moment where it's sort of hard to pin the blame on people who find themselves unemployed because, you know, some kind of, you know, work shy fecklessness, right? This was clearly an exogenous pandemic that's difficult to pin on any one individual. So, you know, when someone is unemployed, is it usually through no fault of their own, right? And our respondents were asked to agree or disagree with this. And okay, on this one, at least for our final wave in September 2020, there are relatively wide uncertainty intervals around this, but maybe we can see a bit of a leftward shift. But again, in the grand scheme of the full time series back to 2014, it hasn't even really undone the full shift from the highs of the 2014 period. Right? So again, it doesn't seem like there's this kind of marked leftward shift here. Those are the kind of aggregate changes then, right? The sort of the collective endeavor logic. What about those who were sort of in particular beneficiaries of government largesse during the pandemic? So the question we want to ask here is, are recipients of furlough income support, and we're including the self-employed beneficiaries as well, did they become kind of extra sort of relatively more favorable to income redistribution compared to everyone else, right? Did they see this large influx of kind of state money and think, aha, you know, like this is what's possible, and so update their attitudes? So I'm going to take a moment to explain exactly what this plot is. So this is the same redistribution attitudes that I showed you before, but now broken down by whether the red line, this is shows the average response for the people who during the pandemic reported that they were furloughed or received the self-employment benefit. Right. So because it's a panel, because we're asking the same people all the way back to 2014, we can track what their attitudes were all the way back to 2014. But the split is based on whether they received furlough payments during the pandemic period. The gray line is kind of all the other people in our sample. So clearly there's an average difference between them throughout the period from 2014 all the way to 2020. But what we're interested in is whether these two groups kind of pulled apart during the pandemic period. Did the people represented by the red line become extra left-wing compared to people in the right line, the gray line? And they really don't. We can show you the kind of formal statistical inference, but it looks really ugly, and Jack Blumenauer wouldn't let me show you that one. But kind of believe us, right? There's no marked pulling apart here. You might think, well, okay, maybe that has something to do with people not quite joining the dots between kind of what's happening in kind of economic terms for them and kind of not understanding the full implications. And so we could also ask, are the recipients of the furlough income support kind of aware of these labor market risks? So they were asked a question, which is essentially, how likely is it within the next 12 months, do you think that you would lose your job, right? And so these are the responses again. So this is, again, the red, those on the furlough and the self-employment scheme, and the gray is everyone else. And what this does seem to show is there's this very marked uptick amongst those who are on the furlough scheme and self-employment. They were notably more worried about their unemployment risk, right? They saw some real developments, and that seems natural, right? You know, if your employer kind of sends you home and says you can't work, we have no work for you to do at the moment, and perhaps you even know that the government is kind of subsidizing your job, you may very well wonder whether your job will exist in the next 12 months. Right. So they see that, but they didn't seem to make the connection all the way to the kind of the policy preference about government action on redistribution. What about the self-interest logic? So again, this is income redistribution preferences. Did people who during the pandemic reported that their income dropped, did they become more favorable to redistribution? Basically not really, right? There's a bit more like noise and chop in this picture. But the basic story is these lines are, maybe you'll believe me, kind of statistically parallel all the way through. I think if you really squeeze the data, if I recall correctly, Jack might correct me on this, I believe you can get a tiny, weak positive effect. But there's no really, really substantively interesting difference here, whereby those who saw their incomes drop during the pandemic became notably more left-wing compared to those who did not. So we don't really see the self-interest story playing out here. So getting close to wrapping up then. So did COVID-19 make us more left-wing? As far as we can tell, no. I don't sort of overstate that because, you know, maybe we haven't quite looked in the right places. And one of the things we're certainly interested in is suggestions about where we should have been looking. But it seems like the answer is no. I guess the last thing I want to kind of float, not least because I'm interested in Alva and Stuart's view on this, is it seems plausible to me that this kind of mass ideological change that I think, you know, was the suggested starting point for this, right? That we'd see these huge shifts, but it may well need leadership. It may not just happen kind of organically on its own as people sit at home thinking about things. It may need political leadership, even if the shock is enormous. And in that light, it seems possible that Keir Starmer's, on the face of it, choice to kind of emphasize competence over sort of, I don't know, the ideological implications or potential implications of the shock may have sort of been incompatible with seeing an unfolding of a large ideological change, which is not to say that was a mistake of Starmer's, but sort of to note that maybe it's not so surprising that this non-event didn't happen, as it were, if there was no kind of elite leadership to back it up. On that note, I think I'll stop. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Tim. That's absolutely fascinating. And Alva, do you want to start by?
Sure, yeah. Well, thanks very much for having me. I feel like I'm in very esteemed company. I so rarely do academic panels like this. So I suppose I thought that I could best add value to this discussion by bringing the perspective of a political journalist and politicians. So I have two main points, firstly about the left and then secondly about Labour. I thought this research was so interesting because I think on the left in general, for all of the reasons that Tim outlined at the very start, there has just been an assumption that this would cause a leftward shift. So certainly in our own coverage at the New Statesman, in big and small ways, I think that has been an assumption. So my colleague Anoush Shakelian, who does a lot of reported pieces, and we also have a data team, so we are using data to inform some of these things. She did a sort of an extended reported piece on people accessing universal credit for the first time in the pandemic. And it has been the assumption of our coverage in lots of ways that seeing people from different income brackets, basically people who have been typically more affluent in their lives up until this point, accessing benefits for the first time couldn't help but have some kind of impact on their politics, their attitudes, on all the metrics that Tim was measuring, couldn't help but have an impact on their politics and also the people around them. And clearly that just is not the case. which is fascinating to me. And I suppose I can't really offer an explanation as to why, except to wonder if simply that already happened, that I would actually be interested to hear perhaps later from the panel as to whether you think that part of the reason for this is that some of those shifts happened earlier, after austerity, and so in a way it could go no further, but that after quite a long period of the Conservatives in government, those attitudes had already changed, and so the pandemic made no difference to it. But definitely that's been an assumption at our publication, but also in other left-wing political parties. I take a particular interest in the Lib Dems for no real reason. I just think they're really interesting. And certainly they have seized on this idea that this pandemic has given us the chance to reevaluate our entire political system and to make really bold suggestions. And that's the theme of politics, you know, here and across the Atlantic, that we have to rebuild. So the idea is to rebuild back better. It's a Tory slogan and a Biden slogan. And so they've taken this opportunity to make the case for a universal basic income for the first time. So clearly that is their assumption. And it's also an argument that you're seeing from sort of random Labour backbenchers. For example, the example that Tim used, given that the government can take people, like take rough sleepers off the streets temporarily during a pandemic, why can't we do that all the time if that is a societal value? Those are arguments that we see from Labour backbenchers a little bit, but I think this takes me on to my second point. The thing that I find really fascinating is how little Labour is affected by this whole thing, in that, as you were sort of suggesting, Labour under Keir Starmer hasn't really taken up the mantle on this and hasn't really made the case at any point the way other parts of the left have been, that this experience of the pandemic and the increased involvement of the state in people's lives makes the case for more of that. Keir Starmer has never really sought to do that, because they are working towards a completely different set of priorities. I tried to speak to some people in Labour before this conversation to get a sense of where they are on this, and as ever, they're quite reluctant to say where they think that the public is on certain questions. They're much happier to talk about what they're doing. But the thing that comes through is that there's really very little political will at the top of the Labour Party to persuade people to be more left-wing on these things than they were already, or to be making the kind of arguments that you might expect. Instead, they are focused, with the new leadership, they're kind of focused on shoring up their own economic credibility. So Annalisa Dodds, the Shadow Chancellor, delivered the May's lecture quite recently. And the thing that kind of came through very strongly from that is that they think that the economic consensus has changed a bit anyway. So there's a new fiscal orthodoxy that it doesn't make sense to bring in cuts in the middle of a crisis. They think that actually the body of opinion has moved on that anyway, and they are making that case that it wouldn't be responsible, for example, to make cuts at the moment or raise taxes. It's not, you know, it's not responsible to be cutting universal credit. It's not responsible to be raising income tax. It's not responsible to be raising council tax, sorry. But beyond that, they, I'm really rambling now. I'll be finished in about 60 seconds. But they think that it isn't responsible to be making those cuts or big changes at this time, the way we already kind of saw Rishi Sunak doing. But beyond that, they really don't want to be making any of these left-wing arguments. Instead, they are just trying to make the case for their own responsibility. It was put to me that it would be a bit self-indulgent of Labour to be putting forward bold ideas at the moment for how they want to rebuild back better. They're really focused on resilience and kind of correcting the image of the Labour Party that people had under Corbyn. So I think that actually, perhaps by chance or because their polling is quite good, I don't know, Labour has avoided the trap of thinking that there's a trend in public opinion that isn't borne out by the data. I'm going to stop now.
Thank you. Stuart.
Great, thank you. Thanks very much for inviting me. And I agree, it was really, really interesting. I mean, a really big, important question, I think, and really interesting. I'll keep it brief, but I guess my comments are all going to be around the same sort of thing, which is, I'm not sure I agree with your theory of what drives people to the left. And I don't, and I, that that's really what, that's really what I want to talk about. In particular, what you show clearly is there has not been a transformation in views on inequality, preferences about intervention on behalf of the least well off, or philosophical views about issues to do with fecklessness. And there's a, incidentally, just in passing, it's not clear to me at all why perceptions of whether it's someone's fault that they're unemployed is a mark of whether they're left wing or not at all. Because in COVID, it's just clearly obvious that if you work in, you know, a cinema and you're closed and you're laid off, that's recognition of that fact doesn't seem, there's no instinctive, intuitive reason I can see why that would correlate with one's left-rightness. But anyway, that's a small issue in passing. In general, I don't think that the thing that drives people towards Labour and the left in general is changing incidence of support for wealth redistribution and philosophical views on inequality. Much more important, in my view, is a view about a legitimate role for expanding, a legitimacy for expanding the role of the state, and in particular for renewing public services. That seems to me a much better driver of people to the left in terms of their expressed political preferences and their propensity to vote for non-right-wing parties. And this isn't directly measured. I'm sure it's connected in lots of subtle ways with the things you are measuring here. But it seems to me that's a much more plausible transmission mechanism from crisis to a higher probability to vote for non-conservative left-wing parties. And let me say a bit more about why COVID might actually be a case for this. And this seems to be the story of 1945, by the way. I mean, we don't know because the data is obviously completely ropey for what drove that. But it seems to me that it's not just an excuse for Labour. But I'm very happy to be critical of Labour. And I personally would like to have a lot more of what Al was talking about the vision thing. I absolutely think that should be much more conspicuous than it is. But it seems to me that we are still, people feel, and rightly, we are still in a crisis. And people's view about that is quite different from the view that you would express when your crisis is receding and you're looking to build in a different way. And Labour has always thrived when you've transitioned from phase one to phase two, as it did in 45 and in 97. I suspect in 97, there wasn't a booming, someone here will contradict this if it's wrong. I don't think there was a booming surge in views on inequality in 96, 97 that led to a Labour landslide. It wasn't to do with that. It was a sense that the public realm needed to be refitted in a big way, I suspect, and Time for a Change and Blair and all those other things. So that seems to me an important, 45 and 97 suggests that actually the driver for people to go left is probably more to do with views of the state, and in particular views of the public realm needing to be replenished. And one of the key things, it seems to me, in the crisis in the next few months is how we emerge in our collective view and people's individual views about whether the state is fit for purpose. If the right can be robbed of the perennial critique that the state is just rubbish and can't do the sorts of things that the left always demand the state does. I mean, ironically, it's the right that is massively investing in the state's ability. And if vaccine rollout, unbelievable scale of fiscal support, furlough, et cetera, had been seen to be strongly supported and moderately successful, then it seems to me that the left has a much better argument on the in phase two for saying trust the state to do some, you know, things when it comes to climate change or when it comes to a new social care system, all the sorts of things that the left might want to compete on. And politically, it's really important to know that to realize, it seems to me, that the left does much better when the ranking of issues in public opinion puts the things that the left tends to be preferred on number one, number two, and number three. And that's probably the most important thing that the crisis politically can give the left, is people care about a different kind of health service or a replenished health service or a different kind of social care system or climate change, whatever it might be. If those things tend to be in the top of the list, I think the left's in business again. So for me, that as a transmission mechanism is a much more plausible one. One last thing, which is, what was I going to say? No, I think that's it. That was my last thing. I'll stop there. Thanks.
Thank you. Tim or Jack or Tom?
Can I come back quickly? Because I think I have a picture that I think speaks to one thing that Stuart was saying at the end there. I probably would have or should have shown it the first time round, but the data that we have are a bit more sparse for this one. And so I opted for the redistribution preferences. Forgive me, okay. So this is, it's a slightly different style. So this is the same data set, but asking for people about people's support for higher taxation, well, higher spending on public services, including healthcare, with the warning that this could involve higher taxation, right? So it's sort of trying to get away from an apparent free lunch. And so again, higher values here are more the more left wing, if you like. And so we can't go all the way back, at least the way I have it here. I don't think we can go all the way back to 2014, but it doesn't obviously scream a big leftward shift during 2020. Now, I don't want to sort of overstate the case here. And I think part of my, unevidenced, is it the competence choice that Starmer made, but my part of my unevidenced claim is like, I think I kind of agree with you, Stuart, that that going into that, that phase two, as you put it, may well be a moment of opportunity for the left, but I kind of think they have to say it and join some of the dots. I kind of think they have to say something like, we need to build the NHS in a way that it's more resilient, or we need to, be thankful to the staff or whatever. I don't think it, the data so far seems to suggest that unless there's some kind of leadership on those sorts of questions, then it doesn't just mechanically happen at the mass level. But I actually kind of think that the way you even put it, Stuart, seemed to be in those terms, right? That Labour could then come out and start making that case. And I guess we certainly haven't seen it yet. But that's all I wanted to say on that one.
Anna, could I come in very quickly?
Yeah.
So I wanted to say two things. One of which is that I think Stuart's point about services is quite crucial, and it makes me wish that we'd asked about social care now, because I think social care policy and what happens to care homes is going to be one of the big political issues of the next few years. I also wanted to agree with something that Alva said, which is about ideological change before the crisis. Now, I'm a bit obsessed with this because I'm currently writing a book about it, but if you look at what's happened to beliefs about the welfare system and welfare users, there's been a huge shift since the early 2010s back towards favoring welfare users and favoring a more generous welfare system. And that predates the crisis. And there are many reasons for that. But I think the sort of Marcus Rashford campaign, which has very clearly caught the public eye, shows, I think, that there's political space for some new direction in welfare policy. And in some sense, I think universal credits have both gone too far in reality and are widely perceived to have gone too far by the public and also by the press. So I think in addition to social care, what happens to the benefit system and what happens to universal credit is going to be a really interesting political debate over the next few years. But, and I think the big but is, those changes clearly predate the crisis. And I don't think in some sense those are caused by the crisis. And I think Albert was really right to highlight that.
I think I'll also just say one thing, which is to build on this idea that, Stuart, one of Stuart's points is sort of like, you know, maybe these are, this sort of lack of effects reflects the idea that we're sort of looking in the wrong places in some sense. So, you know, maybe we shouldn't expect to see big public shifts on these more ideological measures. But maybe if you start to think about the role of the state or public services or something like that, then you'd see something more pronounced. I think the other area where I don't think any of us want to overclaim on what we found is about whether, you know, we pose this question, which is like, has COVID shifted ideological attitudes? And I don't think our answer is no. I think our answer is not yet. It's worth noting sort of that the data collection, the latest data collection, I think, for this project is September, if I remember rightly. You could certainly imagine that depending on how the dynamics in sort of in the elite sphere play out, that it may translate into the public sphere later on. And, you know, in some sense, this is what these events are about, right? It's trying to discuss these issues to see the degree to which we can influence that, I suppose. But so I think it's important to sort of recognize that we haven't yet really had enough time for all of these effects to play out at the public level.
And can I just ask one question before we take some questions from people attending? Does anyone have an idea about what it will look like when we're about to move from phase one to phase two?
When the vaccines are out? I mean, it's kind of, it feels like we're all in a holding pattern at the moment. I'm not sure.
I mean, I think it's a good question about kind of when does the first order political debate end, which is, you know, the first order debate being about sort of the logistics of solving the crisis, and when does it move on to sort of the lessons that we can draw from the crisis. And I think, you know, that as Alva was saying, this is a, if phase two has sort of started for some actors already, that, you know, Leila Moran is clearly on this bandwagon already, that she's sort of trying to push towards sort of what comes next, whereas I think that's less the case for the Labour Party. And obviously more of our attention is focused on the Labour Party because we think that they're sort of, in some sense, a more important agenda setter on these issues. That doesn't really answer your question. I've no idea when that will happen. Hopefully soon.
Can I say a quick point on that? So I think that, I mean, I have absolutely no doubt that that if Labour's going to do well, and it's a horrible thing to talk about who's going to do well out of emerging from the crisis, but that's the territory we're discussing, right? But for Labour to do well as we enter phase two, it has to be focused on health and social care. Has to be focused on health and social care. What we know from public opinion and from, you know, we're in an interesting position because it looks as though taxes are going to rise anyway under a right-wing government. So it's not going to be a classic, the left want your taxes to go up and the right don't. So we're not in that territory. So there is going to be ground here to be debated. But what's fascinating with the Second World War analogy, which obviously has its limits, is that everyone's focused at the moment politically on whether the government's handling, in particular of health and education, but other things as well to do with the economy, during the crisis will be the thing that, once we come out of it, will be politically a weakness for them. But for me, one of the things the Second World War showed, 45 showed, is that actually reviving memories of the Tories in the 1930s and the legacy of excessive laissez-faire during the 1930s was really powerful. It's been shown to the extent that data allows it to be shown in 1945. And I think that one of the most powerful things for Labour is going to be, particularly in health and social care, that the Conservatives had 10 years to have a health and social care system that met the demands of a crisis, and it conspicuously didn't. And it's that lack of preparedness that makes the case for investment, not the handling during the crisis, but the run-up. And I think Labour will succeed to the extent that it can animate that argument about the austerity roots of the problems of the crisis, if you see what I mean. Because that's a forward-looking argument too, about a sort of never again, and we have to do what it takes as a country. So it goes back to what I said earlier. I think Labour has to tell a story, a about a collective effort to make public services stronger, which connects to the experience that everyone's gone through. And that is obviously connected to inequality and unemployment, but it wouldn't be the primary sort of buttons to press to get the kind of correct response from the voters, if you see what I mean.
Okay, thank you very much. It's just absolutely fascinating. And we've got questions. So if we could take the first three in a minute. So it's Raymond Newell, followed by Ruther Iden, and then Martin King. We're going to take them in groups of three. So if those three people could get ready, and Raymond Newell, first of all, if you could unmute your microphone and ask your question first, please.
Hi there. Thanks for a great discussion panel. I was wondering whether a systematic body of policy proposals with some kind of large-scale media attention, not to stress the World War II analogies too much, but a kind of beverage report for the post-COVID Britain could be needed for the kind of shift in public attitudes that hasn't quite arisen yet.
Thank you. That's a really excellent question. And by the way, anybody who wants to specifically direct a question at one or more of the panelists, please do. Ruther Iden. Or is Ruth able to unmute her mic? Okay, shall we go to Martin King?
Hi. Sorry, thank you very much. The discussion was very interesting. My question really is, how would you explain public attachment to ideas that feel they've been exposed as incorrect by the crisis? So I'm thinking about things like the idea that poverty and unemployment is a moral failing that people are responsible for personally, rather than things that are out of their control. And the wisdom of austerity and having a sort of safety net that sort of punishes people. So for example, I was thinking, could it be the comfort of believing in a just or a safe world where bad things don't happen to good people, or if you work hard and follow the rules, you won't need government support? Because that feels intuitively to me like a potential explanation for this kind of attachment to these ideas. How does this change if the crisis is not sufficient to sort of shift these kind of perceptions?
Okay, thank you. And do we have a third question from Ruther Iden, or shall I read it out? That question was, is it just too early to know what the impact will be? So I suppose it's coming back to what we were talking about in terms of, are we still in phase one? So Raymond's question about a beverage report, who'd like to answer? Tom.
Well, I'm certainly very happy to start us off. And I think for reasons that are not even connected to the pandemic, a major rethink on welfare policy is needed. The beverage report, of course, mainly about social security, but also with other parts of the system. And I think for the welfare system in particular, you know, we haven't figured out a way to run a good welfare system in an age of automation and labour market polarisation. And I'm a bit of a personally a UBI skeptic, and this isn't a UBI event, so I won't bore you with that. But I do think that the welfare policy is in search of a paradigm, and that paradigm's not arrived, and there is a massive political space for that. So I strongly agree with that. Alva, I think you've had your hand.
Yeah, Alva.
Yeah, thanks. So I think that the interesting thing about this is that we have already seen attempts at this predating the crisis. So the Conservatives' 2019 election manifesto, it doesn't fit that description in every sense at all, but certainly the offer or the general vibe of it was to move away from a message of austerity and the need for fiscal prudence and towards one of investment in infrastructure. And the strange thing was, I was at an event at the IFS on the budget just as coronavirus, it was the sort of start of March. I'm sure everyone remembers when Rishi Sunak delivered his budget and there was a sort of footnote about plans for the pandemic. And then he's had to keep revising it. But I think that the really striking thing is that there was already an appetite for improving resilience in certain areas of the economy. And that case was kind of already being made. The Conservatives slightly shifted at the last election, having made quite different arguments in the past. And also before then, Jeremy Corbyn, in successive manifestos, was making that case. So in a way, we're already at that point. And actually, I mean, I know that we're not quite talking about the end of this and rebuilding afterwards yet, but throughout the pandemic, what we have seen from the Conservative government is that they announced spending in major areas. We saw various speeches from Boris Johnson over the summer saying that they're going to be investing in building and these major projects to get the economy going again when things were eased a bit over the summer. And actually that was just re-announcing money from the original 2019 manifesto. There's been very little new money in terms of these big projects to rejuvenate the economy. That hasn't been new money. Those were already in the manifesto, which I think is just quite interesting. We had actually already moved to a point in the public debate where there was an acknowledgement of the need for certain things. But also I think to go back slightly to Stuart's earlier point, I think quite persuaded that probably this doesn't look like a change of ideological position really. And so Labour making the case for certain things after the pandemic looks more like the case for improving resilience, for a green recovery, for addressing net zero, for looking at as Stuart was saying, it's a problem of austerity, and looking at how even, you know, in 2019, some cuts were reversed, but basically austerity, depending on how you want to define it, was just baked into most departmental spending. Those spending cuts hadn't been reversed. So there's sort of a lack of resilience in government. Spending on the NHS had been ring-fenced, but so many other services had been cut that we were piling on pressure on the NHS. It's effectively been looking at cuts every year because of cuts around it. If you cut other social services, the pressure is piled onto the NHS. So I think that probably we're not going to see a shift in things like whether people are deserving or undeserving, but I think it probably will look more like which party is sensible enough to make sure that we're well equipped for this crisis again. And I think that Labour is kind of already making those arguments in terms of how sensible it is. And we're even, so just quickly on specifically the government's response during the pandemic, Labour's argument has been to borrow an idea from Claire Ainslie, who's done a lot of work on how you frame left-wing arguments. And a lot of Labour's argument has been around waste. And so the government has been spending a lot, it says, but it hasn't been spending it well. So there's been a lot wasted on PPE contracts, wasted on cronyism, that they are kind of making the case that you need to spend generously in certain areas in order to be robust enough to withstand a crisis, but that also Labour will be the most sensible with your money. So I think that when that shift towards the left happens, which I think it really might, it won't maybe look like ideas around the deserving or undeserving poor or how much you want the state to be involved, and much more around what's the most sensible way to run things so you're strong enough to withstand a crisis.
Thank you. Anyone else on that first question of Raymond's?
Yeah, I was going to come in, and I think I guess my So I'm interested in Alva's take on the IFS a year ago. I think Alva goes to many more of these events and follows these more closely than I do actually. But like my sense of the Tory position was much more on the kind of the investment end of it, right? And the kind of regional policy or red wall policy if you're that way inclined, rather than kind of outright welfare reform. And I guess I wonder, like, it seems quite plausible to me that a new beverage report might have the sort of effect that Raymond is suggesting. I'm just not sure that I think the Tories are going to sign up to it, if you see what I mean. And therefore, I'm not sure it will come to fruition. And so I'm not sure actually necessarily that would be the vehicle at this point. I see non-traditional Tory appetites in the Tory party, but not quite in that area. And the other thing I thought was interesting, I'll pick up because Albert also picked it up from Stuart as well, on this kind of the perceptions of the unemployed. And I there's this sort of different views in the Zoom room here. I think, Stuart's like, well, it's just mechanically must be true that, you change your views about whether it's someone's responsible for their unemployment status in May as compared to, January of 2020. And like that seems like I follow the logic of it, but when you ask people a question, it seems like that's not the answer that they give, which is slightly different from kind of whether that's genuinely tapping a left or right wing view. I mean, I think it probably does. Put it this way, I think someone who identified as left wing would be more likely to give you a more positive view about unemployment benefit claimants than someone who expressed a right wing view. So I think it probably does at the very least correlate. But there's something odd about that disconnect, which I think is interesting. I'll stop there.
Shall I go on with some more questions? Because we've got some really interesting ones coming in from Sam Dixon, followed by Heather Ormsby. So if perhaps just those two could get ready. So Sam Dixon, first of all, if you could unmute your mic.
Yes. Hi, everyone. So I just wanted to ask, so if crises like these tend to cause leftward ideological shifts among the public, what things or events might cause rightward shifts among the public?
That's great. Thank you. And Heather, please.
Thank you. I just wondered if the panel think that some of the survey responses are based on fear. For instance, that there's no increase in desire to pay more tax to improve public services, and perhaps a consistent suspicion of people claiming benefits. And so what has happened in the pandemic has led people to want to protect what they have as individuals and families. And that's a kind of selfishness has been exacerbated by the pandemic, which can sort of lead to more right-wing views.
Wow. Those are brilliant questions. What about the first one? What might cause a rightward shift? Stuart, are you?
Yeah. Well, I think it's a good question. I think what causes rightward shifts historically, I guess, are economies that shudder to a halt and stop working very well. A perception that enemies of a sellable story that a combination of bad left-wing politicians and trade unions bugger things up. Terrorism. I mean, there's a few things that drive things to the right, but I mean, in general, the left. It's striking that the left, at least in Western Europe, does better when there are better times. Maybe it's because of this sense that someone, as one of the questioners said, that people need to feel that the left are trusted less in sorting out crises. They're much more trusted to do the rebuilding once the crisis is over. And that I think is a quite a sound generalizable rule that center left and left should follow. I just wanted to go back, connect that with something that Ruth's question about is it too early to know what the impact is? I think one of the fascinating things about this crisis is, and I don't know whether the public opinion data bears this up, maybe Tim or Tom or Jack will know better than me, but this crisis is an unusual one in that it's clearly an act of God element to it. I mean, most people consider it an act of God, unless you're a conspiracy theorist about Wuhan laboratories, but on the whole, it's an act of God. It's universal, right? You switch on your TV and you see people suffering in Brazil and, you know, everywhere as a result of this crisis. There's a common crisis that has a universal effect. There's a lot of confusion about what works and what doesn't work, you know, whether lockdowns or whether masks or whether dexamethasone drugs. There's informational confusion permeates the way people see this. And there's no clear case of a country that's similar to us that is doing significantly better, except for some countries like New Zealand, who people generally think are in a different kind of category because of geography and other sorts of reasons. So we put all that together, and it seems to me it's not clear why it would be a teachable moment in terms of how it informs your political view, because it doesn't neatly play into a kind of a prior view about one ideology being better than another. You know, if you're a parent, you're massively affected by this, whether you voted Labour all your life or whether you voted for the Brexit Party or the Tories or whatever, whatever your philosophical view. So the cleavages don't fall neatly, it seems to me, with an ideological view. And that's why I think that actually the real political contest is going to be what is the teachable lesson from this as we emerge from the crisis. And you can see already the right and the left jockeying for that, right? The right is going to be a story about recovery. It's going to be running into the next election, Boris Johnson or whoever will be saying, you know, don't let Labour spoil this extraordinary recovery as we've let the, as we, you know, we've let the market rip again, and, you know, income shares are rising rapidly from a terrible low base caused by COVID. Interestingly, someone made this point today in an article that the Conservative government is always talking about, is criticising the state, and Labour was always criticising the government because they're trying to, you know, the ministers are trying to blame the bureaucracy and Labour's trying to blame the Conservative Party in government. And that story is going to get sharper and sharper, right, as we go on. Whereas Labour, as I said earlier, needs to make a story about the public realm needing to be fit for purpose again. And that's its way. So it seems it is too early to know what the impact's going to be. And it's partly because it's such an unusual crisis that doesn't play into our, you know, compared to a world recession, for example, or a banking crisis. There's ideological fixed points that you plug into those crises. COVID is a completely different kettle of fish.
Can I just also quickly interject as to whether it also makes a difference that because we've got fixed term parliaments and because nobody thinks there's going to be an election soon, that may come into it? Tom.
Sorry, Anna, I didn't mean to interrupt if you wanted to carry on.
I was just saying maybe there's also that element that people think that there's not much point in thinking this early on when the government's got such a big majority and they're not expecting an election till 2024.
I was going to say, but I thought the question about rightward shifts is fascinating. And I think the two big rightward shifts in policy in the UK have been the early to mid 1980s and the early to mid 2010s. Both of those followed crises in which the right of the political spectrum was able to credibly blame the policies of the left for that crisis. In the 1970s, it was industrial policy and it was trade unions, and Thatcher came in and of course also monetary policy. And then in the 2010s, it was what the right managed to frame as unsustainable fiscal policy, a boom that was probably fueled by house prices and sort of overmighty public spending. So one answer to that question is it's a crisis coupled with a rhetorical strategy that allows that crisis to be blamed on the policy side. And I think that is absent this time.
And what about Heather's question? It's a really interesting point about whether people are fearful.
I'll just say briefly on that. I think I agree. And actually, when Jack and Tom and I were discussing some of this, this was one of the reasons I was less keen on the tax and spend question, the one that I showed at the very end in response to Stuart, because I worry that The responses to that are kind of extra colored by the, you know, so if your household finances are in a precarious situation and you're asked to say, you know, would you like your taxes to definitely go up, and then some sort of nebulous goodness will come back from the state at some point, you might be like, ah, you know what, I think I'll just keep my taxes down because, you know, that's kind of less risky for me personally. And so I wonder whether that's part of what's driving the on the face of it kind of rightward shift on that tax and spend question. And I do think it's the sort of financial fear, although I can't sort of prove that to you.
Yeah, just on that question of what causes rightward shifts, which I think is a really interesting one, I kind of have a supplementary question on that, which I'd be interesting to hear the rest of the panel's thoughts on, which is, I've had it put to me by pollsters and so on in the past, that actually one of the simplest rules of thumbs is overlapping with Tom's point, that actually if you have a left-wing government for quite a while, eventually there's a shift rightwards. And if you have a right-wing government for a while, there is eventually a shift leftwards. I don't know how that works when suddenly, like in this crisis, you have a right-wing government which has to do a lot of state intervention. But I do think that before this happened, that was kind of borne out by what we've seen, that eventually, coupled with an economic crash, there was a sort of an economic shift to the right by the end of the Labour era, where people felt like the state was too big, there was wasteful spending. And even you could argue that, you know, we've now had a Conservative government which has changed face slightly several times, but we've had a Conservative government for quite a while. And I think, you would know better than I would about the underlying shifts that caused this. But clearly, as time goes on, I think that clearly people must have been feeling the effects of austerity, and that Jeremy Corbyn's election as Labour leader wasn't so much a cause of any sort of shift in those attitudes, but a symptom of it, that eventually that was a one symptom of a trend, that actually under this right-wing government for quite a while, people were moving to the left gradually on certain issues. And so Labour is still ultimately still there on economic policy. And the Conservative government has itself, at least in terms of rhetoric, also moved slightly economically to the left. I don't know how long that will last with Rishi Sunak and the ongoing Conservative psychodrama over it, like who they are and what they stand for. And so I think we will be seeing a debate on the right about that, about how they need to come out of this crisis as well, and that's like far from straightforward. But yeah, I'd be interested to hear the panel's thoughts on that rule of thumb about what causes right-wing shifts and left-wing shifts in general times, whether that's fair to just say that eventually a long-standing left-wing government will cause a right-wing shift and vice versa.
Thank you, Albert. Jack, you've had your, I mean, you answering that or something else?
I was answering a slightly different question. I'm happy to cede the floor though to anyone who wants to directly answer Albert's question.
I mean, I can answer very quickly if you want. Albert's outlined one of the few things that might come close to being a law of political science, and it's a model that political scientists call thermostatic public opinion. So imagine public opinion being like the thermostat in your house. When the temperature of your house gets too hot, the heating will turn off and it will go down to some generally agreed equilibrium level of heat that you like your house to be at. And likewise, when your house gets too cold, the heat will go up and return your house to that temperature that you like. And public opinion appears to behave like that over long periods of time in most countries, that when policy moves to the left, eventually it will dip below a level that the public views as generally acceptable, and public opinion will respond by wanting spending to go back roughly to a level where it was before. So over many countries, many time periods, that thermostatic model does appear to hold. And I think it's certainly part of the story of the 2010s.
Yeah.
Thank you, Jack.
Build on that, that, you know, to use a slightly different metaphor, there's also the pendulum model of election forecasting, which has been used in various contexts to suggest that as the pendulum swings one way, then you expect it to swing back the other way in subsequent elections. I was just also going to say one thing, just to build on one of the points that that Stuart made. I like this idea about kind of, is this an ideologically teachable moment in some sense for the left? And one of the things that I wondered is whether, you know, the current stance that we see from the Labour Party, which is mostly focused on, you know, government competence rather than sort of big ideological divides, whether that's, you know, whether the incentives to embrace that line of criticism makes sense now, but as the recovery kicks in, whether that will make less sense or it will be a harder case to make, sort of just focusing on the failures of the government, and whether sort of, you know, in that second stage, there will be more incentive for the Labour Party or the left more generally to embrace a kind of ideological argument about what should happen next. You know, so it's whether the incentives sort of change as the economy sort of recovers and as the case numbers go down and so on.
Can I follow up on that? Because, thinking about the ideologically teachable moments, the most obvious one is surely the global financial crisis, right? I mean, so easy to sell this as a failure of a sort of right-wing economic model. And I don't know, maybe there was a period when it looked like that would be the result, but I'm not sure that's actually how it played out, right? So sort of, there was a sort of initial Keynesian response cross-nationally, this was when Gordon Brown saved the world or whatever the phrase was at the time, right? But it, you know, rapidly transitioned to austerity, not just here, but across lots of countries. And so I don't know, I mean, it seems to me, you know, I could see the sort of logical scope for, COVID as a teachable moment about the security that the state can provide to its citizenry and so on. And that seems very sort of left-wing friendly, but I guess I'm not confident that that's what will result from the elite discussion as it plays out. The one thing I realized that we actually didn't tackle Martin's question, and I just wanted to flag it, not least because I feel like Tom might actually have a view on this. So Martin's question was how to explain the attachment to moral failings of the unemployed. It's something about kind of the comfort of believing in a just and safe world. And I think the last bit was sort of, if COVID can't change this, what can? And I partly from talking to Tom a bit about his book and seeing his tweeting recently, I think he thinks that the news media can have a non-trivial effect. But I don't want to quite put words in his mouth, but I just want to make sure that we didn't miss out on.
Thank you. And actually, we're getting to a point where we've got two questions waiting, and I think anybody else who's got a question, please put it in now. Otherwise, we may run out of time. But we've got two really interesting questions. One on the, and it's Noel Bartels and Dan Levy. So Noel Bartels first. We can't hear Noel Bartels very well. Can you try now?
Noel seems to be on mute on the screen anyway.
Okay, shall I read it? I'll read Noel's out. Is there also an international dimension to the competence question? Will part of the argument revolve around examining how countries who have dealt with COVID more successfully have done it? So has everyone got that one? And then if we could now move to Dan Levy.
Hi, thanks, it's been very interesting. I'm a local councillor for the Lib Dems. And one of the key things I've noticed over the last couple of months has been that local community action has been built up. So people have been fed by their neighbours, had their prescriptions given to them and so on. So I was wondering if it's possible that one driver for people not going to the Labour Party is that non-state interventions have proven to be pretty effective. And the state interventions by this government have proved, broadly speaking, to be as good as useless, things like track and trace.
That's fantastic. Okay, so shall we start with the international one? Do we think that as more international comparisons get made, things will change? Stuart?
I think about this, I think this is a, Noel's question is really important. I think about this a lot. It's a really interesting question about whether in 3 years' time, will British citizens care that the British death rate and serious illness rate was, if it indeed turns out that way to be, higher than France or Germany, right? And it's an interesting question about how people consider relative performance, whether relative performance of your country in a common challenge globally matters. And I find it highly unlikely that people will think that we ranked third in the lead table out of 80 nations and therefore we're going to vote out the government. I find that quite unlikely as a psychological mechanism for all sorts of reasons. Now, I should say, as someone who worked with Gordon Brown during those terrible times of the economic crisis, what was fascinating, going back to what Tim said, what was fascinating about that was, painfully fascinating from our point of view, was having done very well in terms of the immediate response to the crisis. The argument that Labour caused the crisis wasn't really a plausible argument. They said it every now and then, and we got very angry, but that wasn't, no one really thought Labour caused the banking crisis that started in the Midwest, the United States. But what the argument that really hit home was that Labour meant that we, Labour's policies, particularly on spending, meant that we weren't prepared for when a global crash hit, which we were particularly exposed to, considering the size of our banking industry. That was the argument that really resonated, not being prepared. And that goes back to what I said at the beginning. The analogous argument of the left now, which is more plausible, is not that. I think if Labour goes into the next election, sorry to reduce it to an election argument, but it's saying Boris Johnson and the Tories were the reason that so many more people suffered here compared to France and Germany. It just flies over people's heads, I think. It's very difficult to point to things and say that's the reason. And partly from what I said before, there's so much confusion. I think actually there's a lot of understanding that governments were basically trying to chase their tail and catch up with changing dimensions of an emerging crisis as well. So I think that much better argument is to say that they put us in a position where we weren't prepared. You know, the Conservatives have been in power for 10 years prior to COVID. To go back to Alva's point, you know, if there's a oscillation between left and right, well, the oscillation's pretty overdue at this point, you might think. But at least that gives the left the argument that there's been a period of preparation that was not really attended to properly in the run-up to the crisis. So I think the international dimension is unlikely to play a serious role in people's calculation about whether this leads them to change their political preferences. That's my view.
Yeah, I think I agree. And another question that I also think about quite a lot is actually by the time of the next election, how much we will be talking about the pandemic at all. And I think that's still an open question because there's a theory in psychology. Listeners of the New Statesman podcast will have heard me say this one before, but Daniel Kahneman in his book Thinking Fast and Slow talks about how basically people disproportionately remember the end of a particular event. So this pandemic is at the moment all we can think about in terms of politics, but depending on how we recover from it and how vaccines work and how much of a legacy there is, I don't know in a few years' time how much these questions of the government handling of it and the death rate and how we compare internationally will even be on the agenda. Certainly at the moment, the polling seems to suggest that people simultaneously don't think that Boris Johnson has done a great job, but aren't convinced that someone could have done it much better, which I think is really fascinating. And it's difficult when we're in the middle of this crisis to know how it's going to be looked at retrospectively, because clearly you could make the case that if Boris Johnson and his government were to take a political hit for their handling of this crisis, it should be happening right now where we are observing the consequences of actions taken weeks ago around the Christmas unlocking, and we're now seeing record numbers of deaths every single day. But it's a politically really tricky, and it's a politically very tricky argument to make. It's not even really nice saying it on a panel event because it doesn't really bear thinking about. Keir Starmer didn't pick up on it at Prime Minister's questions at all this week. And then you wonder, even, you know, when the dust settles and you have this league table, and I think the UK comes out of it quite badly, if there wasn't the knee-jerk response at the time, is there likely to be one in a year or two? I think that the broader question, like Stuart was saying about preparedness and whether decisions taken years before had laid the foundations to respond to the crisis well, I think they will work. And the maybe the broader questions of whether the conservative approach to spending on certain things was the best way through this crisis. But I'm not actually sure if we'll be thinking about this really terrible time so much in a few years, especially because we're not really seeing the impact of it at the moment in terms of public opinion.
Tim.
Yeah, I think I'm gonna sort of half agree and half disagree with Stuart and Alva on this. And I think my instinct is that the international dimension is important, and yet it leads to the conclusion that Stuart and Alva got to. I think the Johnson government would be in deep, deep trouble if France and Germany had, gotten rid of COVID last summer, right? And we were in this situation. So I think the comparison, which is, you know, at first approximation, it's bad everywhere. So everywhere that sort of feels kind of close and similar, it is actually a sort of a political shield for the government. The bit where I'm not so sure, I shouldn't forecast, right? I suck at it. Jack's the forecaster. I'll ask him what his prediction is in a moment. But I don't know. I can't escape the inkling feeling that, you know, that so many people have died and they're connected to so many people, and that's that just might be something that's memorable. At the next election, right? And if the dots are joined by political elites about the, you know, sort of incompetence or whatever, there are an awful lot of parents and grandparents and so on who are no longer here, and that number is getting higher, and it's kind of non-trivial numbers in political terms. I mean, right, there are quite a lot of people affected by this, and I'm just not sure that it's necessarily going to be one of those things that fits so neatly into the forgettable bucket. I don't know. I'm sympathetic to the view that Alva's expressing here. I've kind of seen evidence consistent with it, but this just feels a bit different. I'm not sure.
And we did have one other question, fascinating question on the local aspect, which is going to have to be our last one because we're nearly out of time. What did anyone think? This is Dan's question.
I think this is a really important point Dan raises. I think that it'll become more and more important as we emerge from the crisis, and the Conservatives will try to say, go back to my teachable moment framework, that the Tory teachable moment is going to be that the state didn't work that well during the crisis. Government did, people did, non-profits did, local communities amazing, people behaved themselves. It was the state that let you down. Information's part of the state. Large bureaucracy, the NHS, Ofqual, blah, blah, blah. Dominic Cummings may have left government, but his argument about the state being the organ of failure is going to be a really important one for them. And I think that in a strange way, the Lib Dems, Labour and the left need to resist the argument that even when the Conservatives are in charge of it, that the state is failing in its response. This is the state government distinction, I think, that's going to become so important in the narrative in the next few years. I think local community action, I think people do realise that it's been extraordinary. I mean, food banks and everything else, absolutely right. But I think from a macro point of view, the trick is not for that to bleed into the argument that state doesn't work, and philanthropy and collective action outside the state is the answer. Not the dams arguing that, but I think that's the danger for the left, I think.
Yeah, I think I would just add very briefly on that. I actually think that that is fine in a way for the left, and not that difficult an argument to counter, because the problem when we're analysing the response is that it has been far too centralised. And so actually, whether you're talking about non-government interventions or the state itself, I think that the teachable moment, or one of them from this crisis, is that people closer to communities make better decisions. So for example, like, we didn't use local public health infrastructure, which has decades of experience of tracing contacts for other health problems. We didn't use that infrastructure to do test and trace, or we sort of added that in retrospectively. There are lots of criticisms that I think Labour has made of the response throughout, which I think show that, which completely align with their argument that you need to be handing power back to local people. So whether that is, those are examples that don't involve the state, or those that do, I think that's okay and not too difficult, like an issue to navigate.
Thank you. And I thought perhaps we should close with Tim or Tom or Jack sort of trying to sum up very quickly what they feel this seminar has added to their paper.
Jack.
I don't know if I can sum up what it's added to the paper. I think it's a very helpful discussion, certainly for us to hear, not least to sort of, I've been making notes throughout about sort of a number of different stories that I think we would like to take further, I think, and try and investigate. I think the one that sort of really calls out to me is about the degree to which there is a sort of, there's a latent possibility of ideological change here. So you know, is this a teachable moment, and can we investigate whether it could be an effective teachable moment, were the left to mobilize in such a way that it communicated that idea? I think this is actually something that we've spoken about in the past, about how we might go about studying something like that. And I think that's that it certainly strikes me that that's a more sort of a more present part of the discussion than we'd given attention to so far. So I think that's very helpful for us to take away. And the other thing to say is just a big thank you to all of the people who've attended, and to Alva and to Stuart, of course, and to Anna for coming along. So yes, thank you.
Well, thank you very much. And I'm sorry we didn't get to all the questions.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thanks, all.
Thank you for joining, everyone. Good evening.
Bye.